Accession number 30025, Reel 1.
Can you tell me where and when you were born?
I was born in Sedgefield, Tony Blair's constituency, in 1954.
And what was Sedgefield like?
Oh, I'm not quite sure. I actually didn't live there. I was born there, but I used to live in a town called Bishop Auckland. That's where my family were. And I was one of seven, one sister and six brothers, and five brothers.
Big family.
Yeah, it was in obviously the northeast of England, which was mainly colliery, the pits. My two older brothers joined the, went into the colliery straight from school, and it was something that I wasn't going to do.
Why was that?
My father had ill health with the colliery, with emphysema and asthma, and all the rest of the diseases you can pick up from coal dust, and it wasn't for me.
You knew that even at that early age.
Yeah. I mean, I I'll just give you a bit of history on my schooling, because I was in, when I was in junior school prior to going to secondary modern school, I was sort of number three in the school, going to put it that way. And I was very happy with my education up until about the age of 11. And then I had a serious illness with kidneys, which put me out of school for 2 to 3 months. And then when I went to join, I was expecting to go to grammar school, but I was graded and put into a secondary modern school, which I wasn't happy with. And not only that, I was put in the lowest grade in the first year, which really, I think, turned me against education at one stage, because I used to love schooling up to the age of 11, and then once that had happened, I sort of lost interest a bit. But to a certain extent, I was working hard to get back to the top level. And within a year, I was up in the top level, but it had seemed to be a bit of a downer on my education. To me it did, because I was so disappointed and let down by the system because I didn't take the 11 plus. That was the reason, and that because of the illness, and I couldn't understand how they could grade me when I was sort of top three into the lowest form.
Did you, at that age, did you have a sense, were you thinking about particular careers or jobs?
No, I was, because, to be very honest, we were a poor family. We used to struggle, and I don't mind admitting that, and we're very poor. And I had paper rounds, I had log rounds, I had a milk round. The milk round used to pay for the milk for the family, so I didn't get any wages from the milk round. The paper round I would do at the same time as doing the milk round. So I'd pick a paper bag up on the way round with the milk, and deliver papers. We'd get our papers bill paid by doing the paper round, and then I used to do a log round on a Saturday and a Sunday, delivering logs with a farmer. Kindling to the various houses, and that would give me half a crown for the weekend, and nine times out of ten that would go to my mum, because we were a poor family. But the education side was really a downer for me, because I lost interest. And then come to the sort of final year when I was about 14, I was more interested in the gardening side of the schooling than the actual academic side of it. And I always remember getting a report from my headmaster saying something like, used to work hard but would make a good rabbit breeder. And that was my final report from my headmaster leaving school.
How did that make you feel?
Well, it was probably my fault, because I was more interested in rural studies than I was in the academic side, and I just didn't enjoy schooling towards the end. So I didn't leave school with any form of qualification whatsoever.
What did your mum do?
I looked after the kids. There was lots of us. She didn't actually work. My father was a self-employed aerial erector come TV repairman, self-educated. He never went any courses. He just picked up as he went, because of his ill health from the collieries.
So he'd been in the mines before.
Yeah, and that's what he did. And then when he obviously was disabled from the mines, he obviously needed something to do, so he started doing TV repairs, and he just picked it up as he went along. He didn't have any training, which he did quite well. But my own personal future, then there was no way I was going to go in the collieries. There was no way I was going to go in the pits, and it was either, you know, Borstal, the collieries, or the army. And it was, and that's the way it was, because it was very, very easy to get into trouble, even if you didn't want to.
Why was that?
Just the way we were. I mean, I lived on a council estate with everybody robbing each other, if you want to put it that way, basically. So then I decided to join the army. My older brother, to me, Gary, he joined the army after he'd been in the quarry for a couple of years, and that's what sort of geared me up. So I thought, well, I'll make a career in the military, so I joined the junior leaders down in Deepcut. I actually enlisted in the army in August of 69, and I joined the army itself for training on the 9th of September 1969. It was a Tuesday, and it was peeing down, I always remember it. And I always remember the fact that the suitcase I was given by my mother, I think it must have been some sort of musical instrument box, because we didn't have, we couldn't afford a suitcase. And all I remember, I felt like a little bit of a gangster, because it was about 3 foot long by about 9 inches deep, and it just looked like some sort of machine gun carrying case. And I went to the army.
And what did they do to you on your first day?
Well, in the army, haircut. Within minutes of arriving on the station, I remember being picked up at the station with a load of other guys in a coach. We made our way to Deepcut, and the first thing was everybody screaming and shouting at you and throwing your suitcases around and marching us straight down to, well, sort of marching, we didn't know how to march at that stage, but we were in a bit of a gaggle, straight down to the barbers and short back inside. And it was a bit of a shocker, a bit of eye-opener. And I plodded on from there. I enjoyed the junior leader side, because you were becoming a soldier prior to being 17, 17 after joining man service. So when I actually finished my training in the junior leaders, I was a qualified soldier, where a guy joining the same age as me, 17 half, 18, he was just about to start his training, but I'd just done 2.5 years of it, so I was well up, and that's why they call us the junior leaders.
Can you tell me the kind of things they were training you in at that stage, just for junior leaders?
Well, education was one. I mean, we went to school, obviously the drill, the normal weapon handling, marching. It was mainly prepping you for man service, really. But they had three levels of education in the army at that stage. It was called ACE, where 1, 2, and 3, and 3 was the lowest, and it was an army certificate of education. And I went straight through, so I was qualified to be a warrant officer before I even left the junior service, because we had 2 years of education, which was great. I mean, and that's where a person coming in at 18, he would take probably 4 years to get to that standard. So he would maybe be getting to ACE 1 standard of education by 21, 22, maybe older.
And what was ACE 1 standard of education? What involved?
Well, I would make it equivalent to GCSEs at the time, the old GCSEs, not the ones nowadays, on all subjects, you know, maths, English, geography, everything. I mean, it was there, which was great, because I was getting education that I'd sort of given up earlier. And then I left the junior service, went into man service. And I was posted to an aircraft workshop out in Celle, in Germany. I was a clerk.
So when was this?
This was 1971. End of 71.
And how old are you at this point?
17.
17.
And I was 4'8", skinny as a rake, and a baby, really. But I at the end of the 2 years in junior leaders, the end of your trade training, and my grade at the time, we all had to be sort of clerks of some description, and I qualified as a technical clerk, which was looking after accounting for stores and resupply of equipment to the army. And my specialist subject was aviation spares, and I went off to an aircraft workshops in Germany, 1971, 72.
Did you have any particular interest in flying before this?
No, it was just something that I didn't have any interest in flying then. It was a fact that I'd gone to this aircraft workshops. I used to love going out on air tests, and any time I could get on an aircraft, I was in there. But I still didn't have this big flying ambition. several reasons, because I didn't think I was up to it. I didn't think my academic side was good enough. Because I hadn't done, obviously, the civilian academic side. So I always put myself down a little bit on that. But having been in the workshops for only a couple of months, I realised it wasn't for me anyway, the clerical side. I was promoted Lance Corporal almost immediately from leaving junior service, which niggled a lot of my peers, because they joined the army at, say, 17, 18, and there's me as a Lance Corporal, 17, 18. But the thing is, I'd just done 2 years of training. So I was so in advance of them in qualifications. You know, they couldn't debate it, really, just the fact that I was a young spotty, really. And that was it. I mean, 17, with a tape on your arm was a big responsibility, and I just didn't enjoy the trade I was doing, so I thought, I've got to do something different.
What were you actually doing at that point?
That was technical clerk.
But what did that involve?
It was just accounting for aviation spares for aircraft. So, because I was attached to a workshops, we had a great big storehouse full of stores. I was the clerk, well, one of the clerks that ran the accounts, and we had storemen who handed the spares across. So I did all the documentation. This great big ledger issue in, you know, one nut and one bolt, because it was like that, because the aviation spare system is so expensive. You can get a nut and bolt for a car, cost you 50p, but once they say, oh, it's going to go on an aircraft, it's 50 quid. And I mean, that's the way it went. And for an example, there was a little barrel lock on a door to lock an aircraft door. It was actually from a Renault car, and they were, I'd say, £5 downtown to buy, but because they were fitting to an aircraft, they went up to, you know, £150. It was ridiculous. But that was what I was doing at the time, and I lost interest very quickly. On the clerical side was not for me, and I realised that quickly. So I picked up three application forms. One was for commando training, one was for parachute training, and one was for the SES. And I looked through them and read all the documentation relating to the various units I'd go to. And the SES I'd put to one side, because I was too young, I didn't have the experience, and I knew even if I'd got through the physical selection side, I would probably fail selection because of the fact that I had no military background. So I thought, well, I had the two left, which were the paras and commandos, and I thought, well, I'll go for one of them, and I picked up the paras, and so I went para.
Why was that?
Well, you're a proper soldier then, you're going to be a proper soldier, or a Marine, and that was what I was looking at. I mean, I didn't have this big thing about sort of killing people. I think it was just the fact that paratrooper, you know, nice bearing, pair of wings and all the rest of it, and I was fit, and I kept myself fit, and I thought, well, yeah, if I do it now, then later on, when I'm sort of a bit later on, I'd probably think up the SES side of it. And so I went para, and did a couple of years with the paras. And although I used to like the fact that I was a member of the parachute regiment, and you name it, with the berry and the wings, and everybody sort of looked at you all differently because you were a para, I soon lost not interest. I've got to tell you, because if you went out socially, you can guarantee one of the team would turn around as soon as they saw somebody that wasn't para, would have a go at them, and they'd be, you know, crap at penguin, you know, because we used to have people attached to the parachute regiment who wore the bury but hadn't done P company or the parachute training, so they were classed as penguins, you know, person who wore a bury without wings, and they were classed as crap at, and that was the way they were called. And you can guarantee every time you're out socially, you're in some sort of bundle, and if you didn't join the bundle, then you'd be sort of blacklegged of some description. But so it was one in all in, that was the way we always thought, you know. So if one person was having a fight, he went in with them, and after a couple of years I thought, I can't stand this, it's just a bit silly, you know. And then I turned my side to the Greenbury side and went with the Marines for 5 years, actually. And I loved that. I served in for one commander in Malta when they were there.
Why did you love it?
It was different. It was, and no disrespect to the Parachute Regiment, but I shouldn't be saying this, really, but...
Well, only if you're comfortable saying it.
Yeah. No, it was different. Probably because they had more... how can I put it? Esprit de corps, if you want to put it that way, but it was just nice people to be with. They were very, very professional, the same as the Parachute, but the Marines were great. I mean, I spent a couple of years out in Malta in 4-1 Commando. We went in 1974, we went into Cyprus when the invasion was on. It was just nice to be with them. When I came back from Malta in 77, I think it was, I was then getting itchy feet again. I think my first sort of probably 9 years of the military was I was the unsettled soldier. I didn't really decide what I really wanted to be. And that was my thing. And I mean, when you've been promoted something like 11 times, but still a corporal, gives you a bit of an example. I think I had my tapes on Velcro at one stage. They were up and down and off and on like yo-yos. And I think it was around about 25. And my sergeant major got me in and had a bit of a word because I was a bit of a tear away, really.
In what way?
I can't give you the phrase. I'll give you the phrase, but there's no way you could print it or even say it, because it was a bit of a shocker when he told me. He said to me exact words, and this is not going to be, it'll go on tape, but you're going to have to delete it afterwards.
Well, we can stop it now if you like.
No, I'll tell him. He said to me, the problem with you, he said, you're a good soldier, you work hard, and you've got the right attitude when you want. He said, but the problem is with you, he says, if you can't drink it, smoke it, shag it, you thump it. And that was my career. And I just thought, probably right. And then a few weeks later, I took note of what he said, but I was on exercise, I think it was in Salisbury Plain, been out for about a week. I was stinking, covered in crap as usual, in a trench somewhere, minging, pissed off, wet, miserable. And then they set this helicopter appeared from somewhere with a visiting general or colonel or something. And I just remember looking at this guy. The aircraft landed, the visitor got out and scurried away somewhere. Then the pilot got out, and there he was in his nice flying suit. And don't get me wrong, I'm not sort of funny in that way, but I could smell, all of us, in fact, everybody commented, we could smell this guy, cleanliness. He was 30 metres away. But you could smell. It wasn't aftershave. It wasn't, any form of deodorant. It was just the fact that you could smell clean. And we went, oh, God, you know. And what we would do for a shower at that stage, you know, or a bath, we'd just get out of the kit we were in. And he tiptoed across the mud, which was a bit Nancy. And obviously trying to avoid getting his boots dirty and all that. And there's just covered in crap. And I turned out to my guys and I just said, look at that bloke there, look. He didn't know what soldiering's all about, you know. And then, but at the same time, I admired the fact that he's just come in a helicopter, and in a couple hours' time, he's going to fly back to his base, drop off the general, and have another shower later on, I expect. And that was what turned me on aviation. I thought, I can do that. That's why I said, I can do that. That's me.
And when was that?
This was in 1977, 78.
I'd say you were still a Green Beret.
Yeah.
At that point.
And then I said, well, I'll have a go at that. That's my next sort of thing. So when I went after the exercise and we had a good shower. yet again, straight in the clerk's office, looking through all the documents and DCIs and the Adjutant General's instructions, looking through application to be a pilot or air crewman. And I got both applications out, one for aircrew and one for pilot, and weighed up my thoughts and thought, well, if I go into pilot and fail it, I'll be very disappointed. And if I go into crewman, it's a little bit less required. And it was always my own, put myself down on that academic side. I always thought I wasn't educated enough because of my civvy side. I keep going back to that. And that's always what I kept thinking, am I up to it? So I applied for aircrewman training, went through aircrewman training, passed it, flying colours. And all the way through my crewman course, they kept saying, well, why didn't you go straight for pilot? In fact, on my interview for aircrewman, having done, because you do all these tests when you apply, you go to Middle Wallop and Biggin Hill and did all these tests. And on my interview, when they accepted me for aircrewman training, they said, did I consider going straight for pilot? And I said at the time, yes, I had, but I didn't think at this stage I would get through the pilot's course, and I was going to do a stepping stone of the crewman's course, which they accepted, and they did say on the board, you know, you should have really went straight for pilot. But, and they were trying to persuade me to go at the time, but I still put myself down again, and I didn't actually go for it, so I went for aircrewman training.
What kind of thing did they test? What were the tests like for that, for the aircrewman training?
Which is exactly the same as the pilot's, and which I didn't know at the time. It was exactly the same. It's an aircrew selection you do. You go off to Biggin Hill, where you do a massive medical. They don't do it now in Biggin Hill, it's somewhere else now, but it used to be Biggin Hill then. Do a massive medical, and then do all sorts of tests with instruments, running around, looking at dials of aircraft instruments, telling which way you're facing, upside down or whatever, and not being aviation sort of orientated at the time. I did do well, although I'd been given a bit of instruction by a couple of guys prior to going, saying what they were looking for. And I got through the test with flying colours, and I was happy with that. The only annoying thing was I passed to Biggin Hill, and then the next phase you go down to Middle Wallop and do their tests as well. And I remember, just as I'd finished Biggin Hill, I was called into I think it was an Air Commodore office, and he said I'd failed Biggin Hill. And I said, no, why is that? And he said, the measurement between my knee and my backside was too short to be a jet pilot, because you do the RAF selection. And I said, well, I'm not going to be a jet pilot, I'm going to be a lovely helicopter crew member. And they obviously sent my documents to Middle Wallop saying I'd failed because of this measurement. And when I got to Middle Wallop, the senior doctor, and they said, oh, no, that's an RAF requirement. You're not going to fly jets, so don't worry about that. But I did have to sit in the seat of an helicopter to see if I could reach the pedals and all the rest of it, which wasn't a problem. And then you do the tests down at Middle Wallop, which was a maths and a mechanical comprehension, which is, you know, the old... the old form of engine with the old four-stroke, and you have to give explain the diagram and bits and pieces like that, which was quite good. And I got through that, and I got through my crewman's course, and I went off to 9 Regiment Army Air Corps, which was in Detmold at the time. And I was a crewman for just over a year.
And what did that involve?
You're an aircrewman, you're a left-hand seat, sort of a co-pilot, really. And all you did all the navigation, all the planning, all the loading of the aircraft, and the pilot just flew it really, basically. And that's why after a year I thought, well, I can do that. I can change seats. I'm quite happy.
Were you flying at that stage?
I was flying in Scouts and Gazelle at the time.
What were they like?
They were really good machines. I mean, the Scout, it was the stalwart of the Air Corps at the time. This is just before we had the Lynx. So it was the Gazelles, and it was wrong, we had the Soos, still the old G4. They were just going out of service, and the Gazelles were coming in. So we had Gazelles, and then we had the Scout was still there, which was a stalwart of aircraft. But the only thing is, it's got the aerodynamic qualities of a well-greased anvil if you have an engine failure, because it's going to go down, and nowhere else. It's a heavy machine, and it was a nightmare for engine offs, but a lovely aircraft. And then we had Lynx arriving in the unit, so we got trained up for Lynx.
How were you trained for the different?
Well, you're back to Middle Wallop and do a conversion course. It's about 3 months, the course, and you do a conversion back on the tight, so you know the engines, you know how it flies, the emergencies, etc. Once we'd qualified the Lynx, we were out in Ireland with the Lynx and the Scout still, and the Gazelle, which was great.
What were you doing over there?
Ireland?
Yeah.
Normal tasking, we were troop deliveries, resupply, a gunship of some description. We used to have guns mounted on the side if we needed to assist in convoy clearances or escort. And that was very good. I'd lost a couple of friends out there, which was annoying, but it's the way it goes. It was really odd, because when I was a crewman, prior to going pilot, I lost, I'd say, about three friends, and I thought, it's a nightmare. It was, and people then thought, we'd be dangerously flying, but I thought, we'll get on with it, which I did. I cracked on and applied for pilot training, and I mean, that was just a formality, really, because I'd already got all the ticks in the boxes on my crewman selection. I attended the pilot's course and obviously qualified, and off I went to Germany again, to Hildesheim.
When was this?
This is 1983.
And were you still with the same regiment?
No, I went to one regiment, Army Echo in Hildesheim. And within about 3 months, I was a flight commander, which was amazing, really. And then...
Why so quickly?
Well, the turnover of pilots was very, very quick. And
why was that?
Because the Lynx was coming in. And the experienced guys were getting pushed back on the Lynx courses. So the Gazelle guys were the junior people, really. And you had to go on Gazelle before you went on the Lynx. We didn't have many people go straight through pilot training onto Gazelle at that stage. They said you must do Gazelle prior to going Lynx. And then they changed it later on because it wasn't happening. You didn't have enough people. And so they had to go, people were ab initio pilots going straight onto the Lynx course. Which was great, it's not a problem. And then I would have been 661 squadron, which was the Gazelle squadron, for about just over a year.
What were the Gazelles like to fly? You talked about the Scouts, but can you give me a sketch of Gazelle, what the craft is like?
The Gazelle, they always called the flying chicken, because it's shaped like a chicken leg, you know. And it was the sort of the GTI, if you want, of the aircraft, because it's a lovely looking machine. It's slick. It's a nice fast machine. It's lovely to fly. I mean, it's single engine, but such a reliable engine. And it's just nice to fly. And the pressure's off. You know, it's a really nice aircraft to fly. But then you go on to Lynx. You know, the big old mighty torque monster, used to call it, the twin engines and lots of power, and you know, sticking 8 blocks down the back end. And no, it was a nice machine to fly. I enjoyed the Lynx. After about a year or so, I went on to the Lynx.
And what were you actually doing? What was a typical day like?
On Lynx or Gazelle?
Well, both. I mean, maybe the Gazelle first.
On the Gazelle, we were really taxis. If we weren't on exercise, we'd fly in generals around, or brigadiers to and from various meetings throughout Germany. On exercise, you'd transport them around. But my primary role on the Gazelle was forward air controlling. We did the forward air controllers course, where I controlled jets onto targets.
Can you tell me more about that? How does that work?
Well, what happens is, if for exercise purposes, we would have a target that would be identified by the infantry. They would call us forward. We'd scurry forward, low level, 10 feet off the ground, get into an observation position where we'd observe the target. If we could, we'd get artillery onto it. So we'd talk the artillery onto the target by giving a good reference.